Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips in studio with Project Censored affiliate professor Nolan Higdon. Today we will look at the continuing crisis in Ukraine and Syria. We start with a regional update by author and geopolitical analyst Mahdi Nazanroya with Global Research in Montreal. We look also at the imperialism of the U.S. NATO involvement in Syria and Ukraine with Sarah Flounders, author and co-director of the International Action Center in New York. And we end the show with St. Mary's College economics professor Jack Rasmus addressing neoliberal economics in the Ukraine region and the U.S. European Union sanctions on Russia. We hope you stay tuned. I'm Peter Phillips in studio with Nolan Higdon. Today we're looking at the continuing crises in Ukraine and Syria. We have a regional update by author and geopolitical analyst Mahdi Nazanroya. Then we look at imperialism and the U.S. NATO involvement in Syria with Sarah Flounders. And then later in the show we'll be talking to Professor Jack Rasmus from St. Mary's College. Our first guest, Mahdi Nazanroya, is an award-winning sociologist and geopolitical analyst and author of the book The Globalization of NATO from Clarity Press. He has a forthcoming book on the war on Libya and the recolonization of Africa. He's a research associate at the Center for Research and Globalization in Montreal and a contributor to the Strategic Cultural Foundation in Moscow and a member of the Scientific Committee of Geopolitica in Italy. Mahdi, welcome.
Thank you for having me on your program.
Mahdi, this is Nolan Higdon. Thank you for being on the show. When looking at your book, The Globalization of NATO, you mentioned that NATO has been expanding past its mandate. Perhaps you could explain to our listeners what that mandate is and how it's expanding past it.
The mandate of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, is self-defense. There's Article 5 of the Washington Treaty, which was signed in 1949. It calls for mutual defense. If one member is attacked, all are attacked, and thus collective defense is the mandate of this organization. So it is supposed to be a defensive organization. It was created under the pretext of a threat from the Soviet Union and its allies or satellites in Eastern Europe, the Eastern Bloc countries specifically, after 1955, more specifically, it was the Warsaw Pact that was being demonized and used as a justification for the existence of NATO. But after the Soviet Union collapsed and the Warsaw Pact was dissolved, after 1991, we see that this organization, all the actions it's been taking have been offensive. Nothing's been defensive. Everything's been outside of the mandated zone, which they refer to as the Euro-Atlantic zone, which is essentially Western Europe and Canada and the United States, as well as Anatolia or Asia Minor, that's the Asian part of Turkey. So everything's been out, all the operations have been outside of this area. They've moved into Yugoslavia, they moved into the Eastern Mediterranean, they're in Africa, the Indian Ocean, the Arabian Sea, the Red Sea. They have partnership agreements in every continent now, every inhabited continent. So that includes the Mediterranean dialogue around the entire Mediterranean basin, the Persian Gulf. There's the ICI, the Istanbul Cooperation Initiative. They have what they call global partners or partners across the world. That includes Japan, South Korea, Singapore, now Mongolia, Australia, New Zealand, as well as Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, and in South America, Colombia. So, I mean, this is an organization that's keeping the name North Atlantic, but it's really acting globally. And it's passed its mandate of defense. And you know, after the Cold War, it was called a relic of a bygone era. But, you know, and it's looked for every excuse to reinvent itself. So fighting terrorism, peacekeeping mandates, air taxing, air policing, anti-piracy missions off the coast of Somalia and the Horn of Africa. So it's really much more than that. And we can see that it's invaded Afghanistan, Libya, aside from the war in 1999 against the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, which essentially was one of the pressure points that dissolved what was left of Yugoslavia. So Montenegro broke away from Serbia afterwards and they took Kosovo by force. So this organization is way past that mandate of defense.
Mahdi, this is Peter Phillips. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
In your book, you have a dozen countries that have joined NATO, all the Eastern Bloc countries from Albania to Romania and Poland and Latvia and Hungary. Does NATO have designs on the Ukraine and Georgia or even Syria? What's the motivation there?
Well, it definitely, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization definitely wants NATO to enter. As we speak, there are Polish arms and Polish troops on the border, as well as supplies are going in from Poland into Ukraine. Maybe some listeners might know that NATO and Ukraine have a partnership agreement. It's actually a strategic partnership agreement on the lines of the NATO-Russia Council. And, of course, NATO has always wanted Ukraine to, many members, and specifically the United States, have wanted two countries in the post-Soviet space or the former Soviet Union to join. One's Ukraine, the other one's Georgia. And there's advanced levels of cooperation with both. In Georgia, for example, after 2008, after the war over South Ossetia, NATO actually integrated Georgia into its air defenses, even though it's not a member. In Ukraine, the situation is much different. During this entire simmering crisis in Ukraine, NATO actually held war games with the Ukrainians. You know, Ukraine is a polarized country. I think that a slight majority, does not want the country to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And in fact, the Crimea, when it was part of Ukraine, the autonomous Rada or Duma there, the parliament, passed legislation calling Crimea a no NATO zone. So, I mean, the country has been very polarized on this. And a slight majority does not want entry into NATO. But that hasn't stopped NATO from pushing eastwards and from trying to basically support any political factions, the majority of which are all corrupt, in Kiev that would actually push for Euro-Atlantic integration, which would mean NATO and the European Union.
Madi, a year ago, when Yanukovych's government was overthrown, certainly there was a number of elements involved, most violently the fascist parties and people there. To what degree did NATO or the U.S. instigate that coup? And what's the current status now? Where do we stand? We just had an election last weekend, which was boycotted by half the country. So where do we stand today?
Well, I followed the election very carefully. And before I speak about the election, well, I'll say one thing about it. Basically, in Ukraine now, the so-called war party, as it's called in that part of the world, they refer to the people like Yatsenyuk and the leader of the Radical Party and the leader of Svoboda. They refer to this grouping, and even President Petro Poroshenko, they refer to them as the war party. And the war party has won in Kiev, in Ukraine, actually. Even though this was the lowest turnout ever in Ukraine's parliamentary election history, it's between 51% to 52% turnout, and the parties that got about 83% of the seats in Rada, or 83% of the turnout vote, sorry, they actually have basically about 10% of the population support. So 82 point something percent of the vote holders actually represent about 10% of the population. But speaking about how NATO and the United States are involved, well, a lot of these oligarchs and political figures, including Mr. Yatsenyuk, have been deeply involved with pilot projects, consensus building, and exchanges with Washington and NATO. Since I'm in Canada, I'll give you one example. In eastern Canada, in the Atlantic provinces, which are next to New England, there was a forum that was started called the Halifax International Security Forum. Its headquarters is in Washington, D.C. The funding for it is very questionable because the government here did some illicit things to get the funding, but that's a different matter. Some of the first guests were people from Georgia and Ukraine that are involved with foreign policy. And those people now are actually, in the years since then, came into power. So Mr. Yatsenyuk is one of them. His foreign policy advisor came. And that entire mechanism there was on expanding NATO and the European Union. It also discussed things like challenging Russia, challenging China, regime change in Iran and Syria. This is what was talked at these workshops, which bring these elite figures from around the world, where they build an international consensus. And then there's funding for workshops in Ukraine amongst activists. And at these workshops, they talk about European standards. What are European standards? They try to present the European Union as a higher civilizational entity. They try to present NATO as the proper alternative to a backwards Russia. This is actually cultural imperialism. It's very demeaning to Russia. And if we're speaking about these ideal types, these so-called European standards, which means your EU standards, the present elections in Ukraine have nothing to do with them. When you try to assassinate candidates, when you're beating up people during debate, when the media has been clamped down and shut down, lots of it. Segments of the media have been clamped down in Ukraine. And the Washington, NATO, and the European Union have given a thumbs up to this. When this election was held in an environment of violence, fear, and coercion. You know, they've been attacking the Communist Party, for example. Its offices have been burnt down, members attacked, people killed. It was outlawed. A lawsuit was started. An unconstitutional lawsuit was started to basically weaken it. The Party of Regions, which used to represent 40+% of the population, didn't even bother to run. And as I said, 82% of the turnout vote from registered voters went to only 7 parties that only represent 10% of the population. This is really very important.
We think that's really important, too. And some parties were banned. The old Communist Party there was not allowed to participate. We're speaking with Mahdi Nazin-Raiya, who's a global research person out of Montreal and geopolitical analyst. And he's also co-author with us in a new book called Flashpoints in Ukraine, edited by Steve Lenman. So we have a chapter in that as well, and we certainly enjoyed reading your work. So what's happening? I mean, where do you think this new government's going to go? Are they going to reinitiate military action against the Russian separatists?
Well, I think we should be careful with our wording, because a lot of those separatists actually are not even ethnically, a strong portion of them are not even ethnically Russian. They're ethnically Ukrainian as well. Although Russian is the predominant language there and the predominant ethnic group, are Ruskis or ethnic Russians. This is a much broader issue. It's an issue of political differences, too, and cleavages within the country. It's not just an ethnic issue. Yeah, we are going to see fighting because, as I said, the party of war, and the reason they're called a party of war has won is because they all support war. I want to bring something up. As some listeners might know, a peace agreement was signed. The Minsk protocols were signed at the start of September. And the president, Poroshenko, now we have to remember, became president in the context of a deep political and economic crisis in this country, in Ukraine. So Kiev was defeated in East Ukraine. Donbass, there's no question about it. The Ukrainian military and the National Guard, which you can parallel to the Nazi Germany's SS, because it's a political unit. Basically, the National Guard are right-wing militias that have been integrated into the Interior Ministry and working alongside the military. Their leadership, that is, the heads of each unit. There's a lot of draftees in it. And their draftees are actually protesting now because they want demobilization. They're saying, oh, well, if a peace agreement was signed, why are we still here? It's past our tours of duty. Some of them have been past 6-7 months past the tour of duty. And they're saying, if there's no war and we have peace, why are we fighting? I want to point out that a large portion of the population wanted the fighting to end in the east as well. And because there was internal rivalries in Kiev, Poroshenko, he's been showing a hawkish face, but he's basically had to sell this peace agreement first as it wasn't a defeat. We're the victors. We have the upper hand. But at the same time, they've used this peace agreement with Donetsk and Luhansk. They've used it to reorganize. And basically, behind the front line, they've been reorganizing. And that's why I'm talking about Polish arms are coming in, help from the U.S. and NATO. So in spring, you might see fighting. And this was basically this posturing. At the same time, it was there was a hawkish face. But at the same time, because there was peace, it helped Poroshenko to an extent gain votes, because he believed his party. He has a bloc called the Petro Poroshenko bloc. They were the front runners. They believed they could get 40-50% of the vote. That didn't happen. The highest portion of the votes actually went to Yatsenyuk's Popular Front or the People's Front, even though Poroshenko got more seats because the electoral system in Ukraine is in part proportional and in part first-past-the-post win. So because of that mechanism, Poroshenko has the most seats now in parliament. But he started off with a weak presidency, and he basically wanted to concentrate power, and the only way was to get more seats in parliament. That's why he had to sell this peace agreement to the ultra-nationalists, and as well as to the peaceniks in Ukraine who didn't want the fighting to continue. So this has been actually a pause. The conflict hasn't been frozen. I know that since the peace agreement was talked about, they were saying this is another frozen conflict in the post-Soviet space. So like the one in Moldova between the separatists there in Moldova, or the one in Georgia between South Ossetia and Abkhazia and Tbilisi. So this might be frozen in some people's views, but the fighting never stopped. Like Donetsk airport, the fighting continued. Poroshenko doesn't have control over the National Guard, all the units. The oligarchs have their own private armies, and it looks like the fighting will continue in spring. I think that this Rada election, what it actually has done, this parliamentary election, snap election that just happened a few days ago on the weekend, it's actually just divided the country in two. Into two, because in a few
days, and 15 to 20% of the new seats are part of the Fatherland Party or the Nazi Party, correct?
Svoboda and the Radical Party are both ultra-nationalists. Svoboda got, off the top of my head, I don't know the exact number of seats, but I can tell you that they got 4.72% of the votes from the voter turnout. This is really nothing if you look at the number of registered voters. But because so many people didn't go to vote, didn't go to participate, or because the Party of Regions didn't participate, the Communist Party actually did participate. They didn't get a seat because they didn't pass the 5% threshold that is needed, and of course they were under siege. Pravi Sector got one seat, and Svoboda got several. I don't know how many off the top of my head that they got, but there's another party which is just as dangerous and just as ultra-nationalist, and that's the Radical Party. And they got fifth place, and they got 7.44% of the total vote, and they have several seats out of this. Also, a so-called opposition bloc party was formed. And this opposition bloc party, some people in Ukraine and in Russia are referring to it as a controlled opposition. It's basically token opposition. It called itself the opposition bloc, but it was used to basically get people to participate in this election. So, I mean, this election had an extreme, it was the lowest turnout in Ukraine's election.
And it seems to empower ultranationalists to a greater extent. And we're looking for some more severe conflict there. Certainly, U.S., NATO are involved. Nolan, you had a question.
Yeah, Mahdi, you were talking about how the Communist Party was under siege in the Ukraine. And I was wondering, in connection to your book, The Globalization of NATO, tell us about this process by which countries enter into NATO and how countries like the United States sort of manage that relationship to get these countries to join NATO.
Well, there's brinkmanship here. It doesn't happen right away. When a country joins NATO, it goes through a process. At first, it joins some sort of what I'd say in vernacular would be some type of apprenticeship program. For example, it's going to be transparent about its military spending. And that's a way to actually keep an eye on the country. And then there's what they call market democracy, okay? Market democracy basically means capitalism. And I'm referring to how this program started after the end of the Cold War, because there was a strong chance that a lot of these governments could have reverted to socialism or communism in Eastern Europe, communist parties or socialist parties, and they didn't want to do that. They didn't want any of them to join NATO and then revert to a socialist or communist political party leadership. So one of the other steps is that civilians have to run the military. And this sounds logical, but at the time, the reason was because a lot of the military men in Eastern Europe were pretty nationalist. They were pretty dedicated to their countries. You couldn't manipulate them like you could politicians. So this was another factor. Also, NATO standards. Slowly, NATO standards have to be applied. And NATO standards, it's very vague. There is a military technical aspect, but other conditionalities can be imposed, including political ones. Okay? So the country is basically totally restructured economically and politically before it's allowed to enter NATO. And these NATO standards are far beyond technical military aspects. And basically, this allows the countries to be absorbed into the alliance. And these partnership programs that I've referred to as apprenticeships, what they do is they prevent these countries from looking at any other security alternatives. So they have one foot in the door. They're not allowed to enter NATO, but this basically blocks them from any other real security alternatives. And that's one of the reasons that the Partnership for Peace was established from NATO at the end of the Cold War.
Mahdi, what I hear, we're almost out of time here, and what I hear you're saying is that Ukraine is just one step in the U.S.-NATO building of a global military force that could go anywhere in the world. Ukraine, they would like to contain Russia in a much broader way. So there's fighting over who's going to run Russia and whether there's going to be influenced by the EU or by Russian relationships. So that sounds very traumatic for all of us. Any last words?
Well, the last words are that we should keep in mind that the Russian-Ukrainian people are historically one people, that a lot of Russians and Ukrainians have no ill wishes against each other. And this conflict between Ukraine, where Russia keeps on being dragged in, it's deliberately being fueled to basically create tensions between the two and at the same time increase the influence of the United States in Europe. Because at the same time as these tensions are increasing, the United States is using it to get concessions from the European Union in a free trade agreement that it's negotiating with the European Union, a transatlantic free trade agreement. And that's one of the reasons it's pushing for sanctions on Russian energy, because it wants to sell American shale gas to the European Union. But Gazprom is much cheaper, and the sanctions would get rid of a rival.
Wow. Mari Nazanroy-Aya, thank you very much for being our guest today. We'll sure be back to you at some time in the future. And now we'll take a short musical break.
Nolan Higdon. I'm sitting in studio with Dr. Peter Phillips, and you are listening to the Project Censored show. Our next guest is Sarah Flounders. Flounders is an American political writer and has been active in progressive and anti-war organizing since the 1960s. She's a member of the Secretariat of Workers World Party and is co-director of the International Action Center. She has co-authored and or edited 10 books on U.S. wars and sanctions against Iraq and Yugoslavia, on U.S. use of depleted uranium weapons, on Haiti and Colombia, and on opposing military recruiters. She writes regularly for the Marxist Workers World newspaper and speaks on U.S. imperialist aggression on alternative and corporate media outlets. Sarah, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you.
Good to hi, Sarah. It's Peter Phillips. Welcome.
Hi, Peter. Hello.
Good to hear your voice. I wanted to ask you in a broader sense. We just had Mahdi Nazan Raia on the air with us, who was talking about the specifics of the Ukraine and what's been going on there politically. But I wanted to put a broader perspective on this in terms of U.S.-NATO imperialism and what's been going on globally, in particular looking at Syria and Ukraine as case studies. But tell us what's really happening globally with U.S.-NATO expansion and imperialism.
Well, I think the first part of it is that the problems of U.S. imperialism today are systemic and incurable. They're based on a crisis of the capitalist system itself. And this is a system we all know. It's chaotic, it's irrational, it's unstable, and it's at a dead end. In economic terms, we can understand that. It's a system based on crisis and forces it can't control economically. But when the capitalist state, in its effort to avoid economic collapse, sets in motion forces it can't control politically and militarily, we have much bigger problems. And when we look at ISIS, Islamic State, when we look at the very forces that they put in motion in the Ukraine with the expansion of NATO and direct confrontation with Russia today, the militarism is so interwoven with the imperialist state today, and it's been used for decades to prop up and protect this order globally. And yet militarism, U.S. militarism, is today out of control. So that is a real problem that we need to sort of wrap our head around, that a lot that happens isn't exactly by plan. As a matter of fact, U.S. plans their strategic goals in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Syria, in Libya have been absolute failures in what they projected or expected would be their reinforcing global control. So when you put all that in motion also with they're going to surround China with the Asia pivot. They're trying to surround Russia and expand NATO right to the borders and inside. And at the same time, you have this effort in Syria. And you look at the instability in the region. This is really dangerous, untenable, and unwinnable. And at the same time, in order to carry this out, they are reinforcing the most reactionary and sectarian, divisive organizations and regimes on the planet. Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, absolute monarchies, not a shred of democracy that exists there. When you look at who their allies are in the Ukraine, known fascist far-right organizations that use Nazi insignia, and that is their program also. This is who the U.S. is today in an alliance with around the world. So their plans are failing. That doesn't mean they stop going ahead with these plans or they recalculate. No, they double down into even more brutal plans. There is a flood of mercenaries into Syria, into the entire region, and a flood of weapons. And the same thing is going on in the Ukraine, where you have a shaky, fragile regime that overthrew the elected government, came into office with the only thing they can promise being austerity and without much popularity, and the U.S. has no intention of giving huge funding to prop up this regime. No, they want to use repression and war. So I think it's actually useful to step back and look at the wider picture of what is going on. And know that the one thing that we can expect in the period ahead is peace or stability, because the U.S. economy is in crisis and decline.
I was going to say that the media seems to focus on either these domestic issues or these international issues. And with the UN report about more and more people flooding into these ISIS territories, quote unquote, I was wondering if you could speak to how these things relate to each other. What, sort of convincing, you know, the working class here in the United States why they should be concerned about what is happening over there, how overseas, what's going on internationally in areas that ISIS control affect conditions here at home?
Well, one thing I think that every working person in the U.S. knows today is that conditions aren't getting better. And that has made a profound sea change almost in the hold that the media has in promoting war and in demonizing countries. Because we'll hear Syria or Russia or Iran 24/7, every single broadcast, demonizing whoever is the target of the week. And yet, when there are polls on will this justify U.S. military intervention, troops on the ground, the overwhelming majority of the population, even without any alternative information, says no. Now, that is a departure from days in the past. We could look back to the Vietnam War and going forward in the 1991 war on Iraq or 9/11 and 2001 Afghanistan or 2003 Iraq, where the majority of the population were whipped up for war. So I don't want to overstretch this, but the ability of the media, the corporate media, who's completely linked into the military and oil corporations and act as a public relations arm for the military and oil corporations and for U.S. wars, but they have less hold on persuading the population that war is justified. There's a deep apprehension to that and a growing sort of gut feeling that the wars will cost in terms of schools and housing and future for our children and pensions and all of that, which it's true. It deeply does. It's, of course, the role of an anti-war and a political movement to make those links much more concrete than they are today. But, you know, you can look at what's happening in cities across the Midwest, Detroit being the most glaring example, where just tens of thousands of people, their homes are worthless and a mortgage is impossible and the water shut off and there's just an expropriation that is going on. We could look at the tens of thousands of young people who graduate into indentured servitude because they have such huge loans and debts. So the future here is not getting better. And that connection to endless wars and the cost of militarism, not only the danger of the wars, but the sheer cost here, where the only thing that grows is the military budget. And in order to balance the budget, 10% a year is cut from every social program, cut from food stamps. The very week that they were giving $10 billion to the Ukraine, they were cutting $9 billion from food stamps here. So these two things are intimately linked. There is more of an understanding of that today.
We're talking with Sarah Founder. She's the co-director of the International Action Center, author of, or editor of over 10 books on U.S. wars and sanctions and imperialism. Sarah, certainly, when you talk about capitalism out of control, we look at some of the research work we've done in terms of the transnational corporate class and trillions of dollars concentrated in very small numbers of people, mostly through central banks and money management firms, is looking for windows of opportunity worldwide. So it could be Ukraine, it could be anywhere in the world, to get capital expansion and return. Certainly the U.S., NATO, empire, and the war machine is their agents for allowing that capital to be expanded and controlled. It seems to be a very dangerous situation and inevitable collapse or some major expanded wars. I mean, we were to brinksmanship in the Ukraine, and, you know, we're messing here with Cold War mentalities with Russia. Do you see a direction that offers some hope?
Not coming from the U.S. It's pretty terrifying. I mean, here is, particularly in terms of elections, here's a president who was optimistically awarded the Nobel Peace Prize and came in on a peace platform, and yet you have a higher amount of whether it's drone attacks and an expansion of the military on an unprecedented level, and an expansion of AFRICOM, an action a day in Africa, military actions. So it's not only the confrontations with Russia, so dangerous, and the expansion of NATO, But on every level, there is an expansion of U.S. militarism, and threats against countries around the world are now absolutely routine. It's very dangerous because the decisions aren't made by who's in the White House. They're made by Wall Street and the Pentagon, and they need war. They need markets. They need expansion. And they need to justify an ever larger military budget, an intelligence budget. It's a threat on our security right here in every way.
Sarah, that's an interesting point. This is one of sort of these questions that always comes up with these politicians when they enter office and their record by the time they leave. What is it about the office? What is it about the way the office is structured in the society that has individuals start buying into this? Or is it only individuals who do buy into this type of imperialistic policy can make it to the White House?
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. And only individuals very carefully vetted who do buy into this could possibly make it to the White House and secure the multi-millions and millions of dollars it takes to run a presidential campaign. But regardless of what their hopes or aspirations were, that's not where the decisions get made. That is the very agencies that are set up, whether it's 18 different massive international intelligence agencies or the military, or, as I say, Wall Street that needs war, needs markets.
Sarah, what's very concerning to us here at Project Censored is that the degree to which the media is cooperating with the Pentagon and the White House and the State Department and Empire, and the justifications and the misinformation that's just ongoing. I mean, miscommunications like Russia invaded Ukraine. I mean, you know, we know they didn't. They had troops there already in the Crimea, and there was no invasion elsewhere. And or the idea that the Russian separatists or the separatists, and we were corrected on that, they're both Ukrainian and Russian ethnicities, you know, shot down the Malaysian airliner. And or that in Syria, the government was using sarin gas. And all of these were brinksmanship, you know, presentations, the media going along with it, saying the evil Russians or the evil Syrians or something along that line, that we were pushing it, even escalating it further to aerial bombings and expansion in those countries. Now we're, of course, bombing in Syria, even though it's a new enemy we're bombing, supposedly. So it worries us a lot that most information that's available to the American public is disinformation. Would you comment on that?
It's absolutely disinformation, and it's conscious. These aren't 101 media mistakes. The role of the media is to mobilize the population and justify the wars. And it is unrelenting. And the shoot down in the Ukraine of an aircraft without any inquiry or any investigation, and as it later turned out, Russia had nothing to do with it. But even more consciously is the terminology, where again and again it's Russia invading the Ukraine and the resistance forces there, who are anti-fascist Ukrainian forces, are always referred to as Russians. It would be hard to explain to someone here that Russia hadn't already invaded the Ukraine. And then you have Obama's assertion at the NATO meeting, publicly asserting that there were satellite images that Russian combat forces with Russian weapons and Russian tanks had crossed into the Ukraine. I mean, he announced this at the opening of the NATO meeting. And it took a usually compliant group from the observers from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the OSCE, their special monitoring mission went out of the way to publicly counter this and say, wait a minute, there's no troops, no ammunition or no weapons have crossed the Russian-Ukrainian border. So they had to directly counter what was asserted by the president, claiming there were satellite images and this was going on. I mean, that would be outrageous, and the media should have been all over it, but it went by without a mention.
Sir, those words, we're going to have to leave it with that. That's a very powerful story. And we thank you. We're out of time on this segment. We thank you so much for being on with us. We'd love to talk to you again at some point. That's Sarah Flounders.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. We're going to take a short musical break and move on to our next segment. Our next guest is Jack Rasmuth, a professor in economics and politics at St. Mary's College here in California. His research focuses on global economic inequalities. He is author of the book Epic Recession, Prelude to Global Depression from Pluto Press, and Obama's Economics, A Recovery for the Few. He teaches courses in contemporary economic policy, analysis economic thought, U.S. economic history, and labor economics. Jack, are you with us?
I'm here.
Great. Thank you for being on. We've been talking about Ukraine, American imperialism, U.S., NATO, empire worldwide, the crises of capitalism, and a number of other issues. Talk to us about the economics in Europe and the degree to which the push for sanctions against Russia around the Ukraine kind of has backfired, and what's really going on in the Ukraine today.
Okay, well, starting with Europe, the Eurozone, they are in the process of entering their third recession in as many as 5 years, this time led even by the northern European countries that were previously stronger. Germany, for example, is on the brink and may have slipped into a recession, and France is not very far. Well, it's about the same in France, Netherlands. Previously, the second dip that they had back in 2011-12, that was focused on the southern periphery, you know, Spain, Portugal, Italy, so forth, Greece, and they are pretty much in depression. You know, a depression, you would say, at least a 20% drop in GDP. And Greece, of course, has been in a depression, and a little bit of recovery is going on in Spain because they've reduced wages so much. That's the new austerity model, to attack wages and boost your exports that way. And Spain has been sort of a pioneer in doing that. And they've boosted their exports a little bit, but not all that much. And, of course, we still have well over 20% unemployment in Spain, 15 to 20% in Portugal. So to the extent you get any recovery, it's not really a jobs or wage recovery. And in that sense, not that different from the United States. Although we're sort of going through the same thing, but at a higher level. But now it's spreading into Germany, and it's spreading into France. So it's qualitative a little different this time. It has a lot to do, the euro recession has a lot to do with the slowdown in the global economy. As you know, well, you may know that much of the German economy is dependent on exports, far more than U.S., close to a half. And as the rest of the world slows down, emerging markets, Latin America, China, and so forth, there's less demand for German exports, and therefore, Germany is weakening now. Overlaid on top of that is the business uncertainty about what's going on in Eastern Europe and Ukraine, and the impact that may occur with gas flows from Russia through the Ukraine and elsewhere. And that's having a dampening effect on business confidence and therefore investments. And they can't seem to get together on fiscal and monetary policy. They're still pursuing, in Europe, still pursuing different forms of austerity, which holds back a recovery. And, you know, they haven't had much success with stimulating through monetary policies because they don't really have a central bank like the U.S. does. So all these things, you know, the confidence level, the export problems, and lack of real fiscal monetary stimulus, a very weak banking system, much weaker than even in the U.S. The Eurozone is the weak link in the global economy. And all these things come together means, they're on the brink or slipping into a third recession in as many as five years. Not unlike Japan, which has had triple dips since 2009 as well. Bouncing along the bottom, U.S. is bouncing up and down in the 2 to 3% or less than 2% sometimes. Periodically, we don't get a second or third dip recession, but we do get at least one quarter of negative GDP. So we are in this stop-go thing, but at a little bit higher level than they are. And that has to do because of, U.S. military spending and keeps the economy up, and all this shale oil gas boom going on is keeping it up a little bit, and massive monetary injection that's been going on in the United States, and the U.S. dollar, which puts the U.S. in a position to export some of its economic problems to other countries, which it's been doing. So the U.S. is, going through the same stop-go kind of thing, but at a higher level, and Europe and Japan are at a lower level and in and out of recession. And overlaid on the Eurozone thing is this uncertainty about, the situation with gas supplies in the Ukraine and so forth in Europe, which isn't helping the Eurozone economic situation.
We are talking to Jack Rasmus, professor of economics and politics at St. Mary's College here in California. Jack, the economists who do champion these austerity cuts, what is their defense of continuing these policies, and how do you respond to those defenses and justifications?
Well, the reason for it's part ideological. They believe if you reduce spending and keep wages down and so forth, it will provide more income for businesses, and then those businesses will then invest that income, and that will stimulate the economy and lead to hiring and so forth. But that's a scenario that's a story. It's logical. It's neoclassical economics. Doesn't work that way. You can pump all the money you want into the banks in Europe, which the ECB, European Central Bank, has done over $1 trillion, and the banks are going to sit on it. They're going to hoard it. They're not going to loan it to businesses. And even if businesses were able to borrow at very low rates, and it's like zero rates over there, it's even negative, the businesses are going to hoard the money too. They're going to sit on it, and they're going to try to polish their balance sheets by reducing their costs, which means laying off and so forth. If you look at Europe, what's going on is, to the extent there's any hiring, it's all part-time temp jobs. In Italy, for example, in the last 3 years, 70% of all the jobs they've hired have been contingent, as they call them, part-time temp, same as in Spain. They've been laying off full-time people and hiring part-time temp. In other words, no wages, no benefits, whatever. They're in a whole different second-class citizens. And you get no wage growth, so you get no consumption. And there's no consumption, then business is going to keep on hoarding its savings from laying people off. It's a vicious cycle, and nothing gets going. But they believe that that's the solution, ideologically, they believe.
Well, Jack, in the Ukraine now, there's a right-wing nationalist government now in place. Mm-hmm. Quite strongly, there's current negotiations going on, I believe, in Brussels with the gas prices with Russia, because Ukraine stays warm in the winter with gas primarily and coal, and 60% of the coal production is down this year. So it's not a good picture for the Ukraine or the people there. Wages are down, the GDP is down, and they're looking for, and they've got these huge debts to the International Monetary Fund. They're trying to look for bailouts in the $20 to $50 billion range, and Europe isn't ready to do that, is my understanding. And so are we looking at an even broader economic crisis because of Ukraine and or the likelihood of war? I mean, what does war have to do with all this?
Well, back in March, I've been writing a series of articles on the Ukraine, and back in March, just as they were signing this IMF deal, I wrote a piece predicting that the IMF deal would lead to a Greece-like depression in the Ukraine, and it has, very quickly, in fact. Originally, the IMF came up with a $17 billion bailout package, but $6 billion of that was earmarked to pay the Western banks for previous loans to the Ukraine, so it was only $11 billion. And I predicted they needed, Ukraine needed at least $50 billion. But the IMF is not going to come up with any more money, and the European Commission isn't, and the U.S. isn't. To the extent the IMF comes up with any more money, it's going to be to ensure that Ukraine keeps paying the Western banks. And the IMF package, as I analyzed it back last March when I wrote about it, I said would lead to at least a 20-25% drop in their GDP. And it's already dropped 24%. I mean, you know, I was really even behind the curve, dropped 11% in the first quarter, 4.7 in the second. And I predict it's going to be somewhere between 5 and 10 in this quarter. So they're in a deep depression over in Ukraine already in just 9 months. And a lot of that is due to the IMF package, which calls for, you know, government employee layoffs and wage cuts, 50% cut in pensions, wage reductions, an end to gas subsidies that people are getting phased out over the next 2 years, a 50% increase in price of gas for folks in the Ukraine. So, you know, and then you have overlaid on that the war and the disruption of the economy because of the war, particularly in the East where most of the economy was industrially, and you got a depression. You know, the U.S. coup, and it was a coup there in, you know, manipulating groups on the ground, some of them proto-fascist, really precipitated this crisis. Ukraine was kind of a basket case before it, but that pushed it all into depression. And the IMF is making it worse. It's not really bailing them out. And as I said, they're going to need tens of billions of more. Their currency is fallen the sharpest of any in the world, I think. I think it's down over 40%. And, you know, the central bank's running out of cash to finance exports. It's a mess. And there's no sign of getting better. Now, the Russians just signed an agreement on the gas. Because the Europeans, their economy very weak. They, you know, they get 39% of their gas from Russia. 20% of that 39 comes through Ukraine. Their economy is already very weak. Business confidence in Germany is plummeting. So they want some kind of a deal signed. And they did sign a deal in which Ukraine has to pay Russia $3.1 billion of back payments it hasn't paid for previous gas, and another $1.5 billion to continue delivering gas for the next several months through the winter. So they have a deal there. But, you know, that doesn't solve the problem. Maybe it prevents it from getting worse. But it doesn't solve the problem there, both for the Ukraine, and there's a little impact on the Russian economy there, but also for Western Europe. The slowdown in the Eurozone has to do with a lot of global factors and internal factors in the Eurozone, but I believe, you know, the situation in the Ukraine and gas supplies has exacerbated it and has pushed it the Eurozone, particularly Germany, you know, over the cliff slightly into recession. But you won't find the U.S. business press saying that these sanctions, which were driven by the U.S., reluctantly gone along with the Europeans, by the Europeans. You know, U.S. press won't admit that this has all contributed to the slowdown in Europe.
Well, the sanctions have focused on individuals and particular companies, but not Russia as a whole. Is
exactly.
That correct? Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And they're kind of token sanctions, you know, but they want to pump up the argument that, oh, their sanctions are having a big bite. No, they're really not. You know, they're very targeted in certain areas, certain banks, certain people. and they're not general, because you know, Russia could do a tit for tat here, and Europe is in no situation to really have serious counter sanctions, you know, that the Russians could impose. So you know, this sanctions talk is a lot of talk, and to the extent the Russian economy itself, you know, is slowing, it really has to do with the global slowdown and the collapse of oil prices and so forth going on right now globally.
Some would say, when in doubt, start a war, and certainly the Ukraine is one case where some serious war is possible. We were pushing, and certainly the right-wing nationalist elements have been pushing for the U.S. to be involved and or intervene on behalf or against Russia, which could lead to a global war, and that would, you know, wreck everything. But in economy and in the economic situation herein, we're leading to where the crisis could be so severe to Ukraine that leadership may actually want to seek a war to maintain power.
Well, I wouldn't subscribe to that view. Yes, the you know, the ultra-right, the nationalists, if you want to call them that, were very influential up to now, but we've just had elections there. You know, Poroshenko won, and Yatsenyuk is probably going to be his partner there. And these are business guys, and what they want is to deepen the economic relations with Europe first here. We're going to have to see what the composition looks like. There's some indications that they may want to sideline some of the ultra-radicals, although those ultra-radicals have put themselves in security positions and, you know, certainly want a war with Russia. I don't think Putin and Russia wanted a war or do want a war. They're not going to let the eastern provinces, you might call them, really fall under the Ukrainian right wing's control. So they'll continue to prevent that. But I've always argued that Putin is playing the bigger game here.
We're running out of time here, Jack.
okay.
We've been talking to Jack Rasmus, professor of economics and politics at St. Mary's College. I thank you, and certainly respect what you're saying, and war is certainly not one thing that we would hope would happen. Thank you very much for being on the show with us today.
My pleasure. We want to smash, crash, blast, smash, blast the system. We want to get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud, this pumping rhythm is hitting. We want to make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want, 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 we want a liberated land supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own my special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain, but my people get entitled.
You're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Special thanks to our producer Anthony Fest and Wesley Burden at the controls. The Project Censored Show airs on 20 stations around the U.S. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We will see you next time.
Political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, skies, another guise of democracy, politics of the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxing while the prisons and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief. Divine conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out, the reach on potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love of the brothers and our sisters.